Famloy ang kalawana katulo rali fataga. Famloy ang kalawana katulo rali fataga. Famloy ang kalawana katulo rali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 49th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We'll be opening with the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. We'll have a musical interlude, which will be followed by a story from Lord Dunsany. And finally, we'll finish up with a modern piece of moody music. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 16. By the following day, the country on the east bank had become a vast, marshy plain, dotted here and there by tree-clad patches of higher land. The morning was rainy, a contrast to the fine weather we had hitherto encountered. We passed woodyards and cattle ranches. At one of the latter, the owner, an Argentine of Irish parentage, who still spoke English with the accent of the land of his parents' nativity, remarked that this was the first time the American flag had been seen on the Upper Paraguay, for our gunboat carried it at the masthead. Early in the afternoon, having reached the part where both banks of the river were Brazilian territory, we came to the old colonial Portuguese fort of Coimbra. It stands where two steep hills rise, one on either side of the river, and it guards the water gorge between them. It was captured by the Paraguayans in the war nearly half a century ago. Some modern guns have been mounted, and there is a garrison of Brazilian troops. The white fort is perched on the hillside, where it clings and rises terrace above terrace with the bastion and parapet and crenellated wall. At the foot of the hill, on the riverine plain, stretches the old-time village with its roofs of palm. In the village dwell several hundred souls, almost entirely the officers and soldiers and their families. There is one long street. The one-story daub and wattle houses have low eaves and steep sloping roofs of palm leaves or of split palm trunks. Under one of the two old but small trees, there are rude benches, and for a part of the length of the street, there is a rough stone sidewalk. A little graveyard, some of the tombs very old, stands at one end. As we passed down the street, the wives and the swarming children of the garrison were at the doors and windows. There were women and girls with skins as fair as any in the Northland, and others that were predominantly negro. Most were of intervening shades. All this was paralleled among the men, and the fusion of the colours was going on steadily. Around the village, black vultures were gathered. Not long before reaching it, we passed some rounded green trees, their tops covered with snowy wood ibis. At the same time we saw behind them, further inland, other trees crowded with more of the delicate forms of the shining white egrets. The river now widened, so that in places it looked like a long lake. It wound in every direction through the endless marshy plain, whose surface was broken here and there by low mountains. The splendour of the sunset I never saw surpassed. We were streaming east towards the clouds of storm. The river ran, a broad highway of molten gold, into the flaming sky. The far-off mountains loomed purple across the marches. Belts of rich green, the river banks, stood out on either side against the rose hues of the rippling water. In front, as we forged steadily onward, hung the tropic night, dim and vast. On December 15, we reached Corumba. For 3 or 4 miles before it is reached, the west bank on which it stands becomes high rocky ground, falling away into cliffs. The country round about was evidently well peopled. We saw gauchos, cattle herders, the equivalent of our own cowboys, riding along the bank. Women were washing clothes, and their naked children bathing on the shore. We were told that caimans and piranhas rarely ventured near a place where so much was going on, and that accidents generally occurred in ponds or lonely stretches of the river. Several steamers came out to meet us and accompanied us for a dozen miles, with bands playing and the passengers cheering, just as if we were nearing some town on the Hudson. Corumba is on a steep hillside, with wide, roughly paved streets, some of them lined with beautiful trees that bear scarlet flowers, and with well-built houses, most of them of one story, some of two or three stories. We were greeted with a reception by the municipal council and were given a state dinner. The hotel, kept by an Italian, was as comfortable as possible. Stone floors, high ceilings, big windows and doors, a cool open courtyard, and a shower bath. Of course, Corumba is still a frontier town. The vehicles, ox carts and mule carts, there are no carriages, and oxen as well as mules are used for riding. The water comes from a big central well. Around it, water carts gather, and their contents are then peddled around at different houses. The family showed the mixture of races characteristic of Brazil. One mother, after the children had been photographed in their ordinary costume, begged that we return and take them in their Sunday clothes, which was accordingly done. In a year, the railway from Rio will reach Corumba, and then this city and the country around about will see much development. At this point, we rejoined the rest of the party, and very glad we were to see them. Cherry and Miller had already collected some 800 specimens of mammals and birds. End of chapter 2. The musical interlude for today is from the original Memphis Five. It's a 1923 track and is called Snake Hips. For the main feature today, we have a story written by Lord Dunsany, who you may remember from previous podcasts is cited as one of Lovecraft's inspirations. This story is simply called In Zaccarath, and is read for us by G.C. Fournier.
Come, said the king in sacred Zaccarath, and let our prophets prophesy before us. A far-seen jewel of light was the holy palace, a wonder to the nomads on the plains. There was the king with all his underlords, and the lesser kings that did him vassalage, and there were all his queens with all their jewels upon them. Who shall tell of the splendor in which they sat, of the thousand lights and the answering emeralds, of the dangerous beauty of that horde of queens, or the flash of their laden necks? There was a necklace there of rose-pink pearls beyond the art of the dreamer to imagine. Who shall tell of the amethyst chandeliers, where torches, soaked in rare Birinian oils, burned and gave off a scent of blethany? This herb marvellous, which, growing near the summit of Mount Zaumnos, scents all the Zaumnian range, and is smelt far out on the Kepuscran plains, and even when the wind is from the mountains, in the streets of the city of Arganath. At night it closes its petals and is heard to breathe, and its breath is a swift poison. This it does even by day if the snows are disturbed about it. No plant of this has ever been captured alive by a hunter. Enough to say that when the dawn came up, it appeared by contrast pallid and unlovely, and stripped bare of all its glory, so that it hid itself with rolling clouds. Then the herald stepped through the ranks of the king's silk-clad warriors, who lay oiled and scented upon velvet cloaks, with a pleasant breeze among them caused by the fans of slaves. Even their casting spears were set with jewels. Through their ranks the heralds went with mincing steps, and came to the prophets, clad in brown and black, and one of them they brought and set before the king. And the king looked at him and said, "Prophesy unto us." And the prophet lifted his head, so that his beard came clear from his brown cloak, and the fans of the slaves that fanned the warriors wafted the tip of it a little awry. And he spake to the king, and spake thus, "Woe unto thee, king, and woe unto Zaccarath! Woe unto thee, and woe unto thy women, for your fall shall be sore and soon. Already in heaven the gods shun thy God. They know his doom and what is written of him. He sees oblivion before him like a mist. Thou hast aroused the hate of the mountaineers. They hate thee all along the crags of Droom. The evilness of thy days shall bring down the Zedians on thee, as the sons of springtide bring the avalanche down. They shall do unto Zaccarath as the avalanche doth unto the hamlets of the valley." When the queens chattered or tittered among themselves, he merely raised his voice and still spake on. "Woe to these walls and the carven things upon them! The hunter shall know the camping places of the nomads by the marks of the campfires on the plain, but he shall not know the place of Zaccarath." A few of the recumbent warriors turned their heads to glance at the prophet when he ceased. Far overhead, the echoes of his voice hummed on a while among the cedarn rafters. "Is he not splendid?" said the king. And many of that assembly beat with their palms upon the polished floor in token of applause. Then the prophet was conducted back to his place at the far end of that mighty hall, and for a while musicians played on marvellous curved horns, while drums throbbed behind them hidden in a recess. The musicians were sitting cross-legged on the floor, all blowing their huge horns in the brilliant torchlight. But as the drums throbbed louder in the dark, they arose and moved slowly nearer to the king. Louder and louder drummed the drums in the dark, and nearer moved the men with the horns, so that their music should not be drowned by the drums before it reached the king. A marvellous scene it was when the tempestuous horns were halted before the king, and the drums in the dark were like the thunder of God, and the queens were nodding their heads in time to the music, with their diadems flashing like heavens of falling stars. And the warriors lifted their heads and shook, as they lifted them, the plumes of those golden birds which hunters wait for by the Lydian lakes, in a whole lifetime killing scarcely six, to make the crests that the warriors wore when they feasted in Zakharath. Then the king shouted, and the warriors sang. Almost they remembered then old battle chants. And as they sang, the sound of the drums dwindled, and the musicians walked away backwards, and the drumming became fainter and fainter as they walked, and altogether ceased, and they blew no more on their fantastic horns. Then the assemblage beat on the floor with their palms, and afterwards the queens besought the king to send for another prophet. And the heralds brought a singer and placed him before the king. And the singer was a young man with a harp, and he swept the strings of it, and when there was silence he sang of the iniquity of the king, and he foretold the onrush of the Zedians, and the fall and the forgetting of Zakharath, and the coming again of the desert to its own, and the playing about of little lion cubs where the courts of the palace had stood.
"Of what is he singing?" said a queen to a queen. "He is singing of everlasting Zakharath." As the singer ceased, the assemblage beat listlessly on the floor, and the king nodded to him, and he departed. When all the prophets had prophesied to them, and all the singers sung, the royal company arose and went to other chambers, leaving the hall a festival to the pale and lonely dawn. And alone were left the lion-headed gods that were carven out of the walls. Silent they stood, and their rocky arms were folded, and shadows over their faces moved like curious thoughts as torches flickered and the dull dawn crossed the fields, and the colors began to change in the chandeliers. When the last lutanist fell asleep, the birds began to sing. Never was greater splendor or a more famous hall. When the queens went away through the curtained door with all their diadems, it was as though the stars should arise in their stations and troop together to the west at sunrise. And only the other day I found a stone that had undoubtedly been a part of Zakharath. It was 3 inches long and 1 inch broad. I saw the edge of it uncovered by the sand. I believe only 3 other pieces have been found like it.
That was a good reading, GC. You had some wonderful pacing there. Next we have a piece of music from a group called Ann Hell. It's from their Threshold album and is called Bone Hill. The album can be downloaded for free, and I'll put a link to it into the show notes. Remember, people, I'm on the lookout for more stories. If you've written a creepy horror story set in or around the 1920s, or a story containing elements of the Cthulhu mythos set anywhere, then please get in touch, and let's see if we can't get it onto the podcast. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released under an attribution, share-alike license. Until next time...
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk